I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. As a pro-Ukraine militant in contact with the NATO nation, media became the latest would-be Donald Trump assassin. The genocide continues here in the Middle East. While the full extent of the blowback from the Biden-Harris proxy war in Europe may not be fully known, the US-UK-EU armed assault on Palestine is now engaging Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria and the entire global south. As some estimates of the killed reach hundreds of thousands in Gaza, mostly women and children, today is the so-called UN International Day of Peace. It's dedicated to the absence of war and violence, coinciding with something called a Peace One Day Global Ceasefire Campaign. No one seems to have told Lockheed, Boeing, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems and others whose shareholders financially benefit from the NATO proxy carnage. Today is also the start of Iran's Holy Defence Week, marking the catastrophe of NATO nation support for Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. This year, commemorations are held after an Israeli atrocity in Lebanon killed or wounded thousands, including Iran's ambassador, as well as Iran renewing friendly relations with Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Joining me now from LA is a historian of the Middle East and author of The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture and Identity in Modern Iran, Dr. Asal Raad. Dr. Raad, thank you so much for coming on. So, as I said, International Peace Day. This is being recorded before the events of the past 24 hours as regards Israel's next moves here in the Middle East. Why is your pinned tweet, I notice, on your X timeline, blaming NATO country journalists as much as anyone else for the genocide in Gaza?
Well, that tweet actually goes back to, which is sort of indicative of the longer view of this narrative in Western media and Western political discourse. That tweet is from 2021, and it's regarding evictions, Palestinian families being expelled from their homes in East Jerusalem. And really, when you look at that idea, you realize that in the Western narrative, not only has this sort of narrative of whitewashing Israel's crimes existed for a long time, predating the events of this last year and the genocide in Gaza, but the idea that East Jerusalem, Gaza, the West Bank, they're all interconnected. And yet the way that the narrative is within the West is to separate them and to compartmentalize them as if they are not all part of Palestinian territories and Palestinian liberation in general.
And you change the words of these headlines in the so-called mainstream media in NATO nations. You might have to give us some examples. And clearly, they're going out on social media, not really affecting the media you're attacking implicitly for, I suppose, hiding and disguising the mass slaughter of untold numbers of women and children, men, women and children.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at a language of dehumanization that and what the whitewashing of crimes, right? So there's two sort of components to it. It's the way that the narrative is told in order to avoid culpability for Israel or responsibility for Israel's actions, right? So you'll see patterns where mainstream Western outlets will avoid actually naming Israel within their headlines, right? They will not attribute attacks to Israel. It's just an airstrike or something in Gaza is flattened or people are simply killed, but the source of who is killing them or what killed them or whose airstrike it was, that is often not attributed to Israel, even though that is the state that is taking the action or the actor that is acting in that situation. Then there's the fact that the word choices themselves, right? When Palestinians are killed, the word killed is not used. They simply die. They are not victims in the same way. They are collateral damage. Palestinians, even that word itself, Palestinian, is sometimes not used. So you'll see West Bank residents or Gazans be used. Arabs in some cases, a broad term referring to Arabs within the larger Arab world rather than, again, Palestinians. Palestine, occupation, genocide, these are all words that are avoided as much as possible within Western media. And something that I think is important to note always in these situations is there is a difference between the reporters and the institutions, right? So I think there you often see reporters, and there have been internal stories of internal struggle within some of these institutions, even people who, and we've seen this within the political system in the United States as well, people who are resigning from the State Department because they do not agree with US policy. But it's the institutions that are protecting Israel and its actions, and they're doing so by dehumanizing Palestinians in the process, because once you've dehumanized this entire population, this is how you justify attacks that are happening, that are killing, a majority of which are killing civilians. I mean, in Gaza alone, you have, I think, the latest official death toll, which are all underestimates, says something close to 17,000 children have been killed in the last 11 months. The only way to attempt to whitewash a crime of that magnitude is to dehumanize the population in which those crimes are being carried out against.
Yeah, as Ralph Nader, the man who's arguably saved more people than anyone else for fighting the auto industry, said, it may be close to 300,000 all told. So we really don't know the figures. Journalists aren't being allowed in by the Israeli government. But then, I mean, I've worked in these newsrooms at the highest level, BBC and CNN, and Palestine is not allowed to be used as a term. So are you saying that people, if you're not blaming the reporters, I mean, I took the names down of a few of these people, Virginia Moseley at CNN, these are top level editors, Tim David, BBC, Joseph Kahn, The New York Times, Sally Berbee at The Washington Post, Politico, John Harris, The Hill, Bob Cusack, Fox News, Murdoch and Porter Berry. I mean, these are the names of these people, Sky News, Jonathan Levy. Are they complicit in genocide? Rebecca Blumenstein of NBC News, Alicia Cullen, these are the highest level editorial people. The BBC has more to worry about, arguably, because their highest paid journalist has just been done for child abuse. But what about all these people, the names I mentioned? Do there need to be a Nuremberg-style court for these people?
I think there's certainly media complicity. And when I say, the reason I point out the fact that there are reporters who are trying to do good work is because I don't think we can paint everybody with one brush, right? I think there are certainly reporters within these institutions that do take issue with what's going on and do try to do good reporting, but
Not that I saw at the BBC. I'm sorry to interrupt. Having a long, long time, 30 years of experience, I didn't see many in all these different institutions. What about American media in Eisenhower Igi then? Why didn't they make a bigger deal of this American that was shot dead?
So let me base my answer on the fact that I also watch State Department briefings and White House briefings every day, right? So I see, and there's a large portion of the people in the room who are not really pushing back, but there are reporters who are pushing back. They are trying to get the answers. And so that's why I say, I just don't think that I think that the attack is more appropriate on people who are in positions of power versus the reporters who are trying to report what they are, right? Anybody who writes an article knows that it's not the journalist that picks the headline, right? It's the editor that picks the headline. So in terms of complicity, I would say the complicity is higher up typically. Of course, there are probably journalists who agree or use egregious language in certain situations intentionally so. But my point is more to say that there are certainly, especially within the independent world, even within the mainstream media, I think there are individual reporters that are trying to do good work. In terms of complicity, the media's broad complicity is extremely important, and they certainly are complicit. And as a historical example of this, right, we're looking at something that's happening right now. But if you look back to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the job of the media, in what we champion is a free press, right? In the Western world, the idea that we have a free press is championed as a cornerstone of democracy. And yet, what does it mean to have a free press? A free press means you don't repeat what the official state narrative is. You don't just listen to whatever. If the president said so, that means it's true. You challenge that narrative because the job of the journalist is to find truth. And in the case of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, that's absolutely not what the media did. The media parroted whatever the Bush administration said at the time, which we now know as a fact, were fabricated lies, but they didn't challenge it at the time. And that's the kind of reporting that we need to be seeing, something that challenges the idea that, you know, if Israel says they're targeting militants, this is just repeated as fact. Whereas in reverse, if we're talking about the bias within the media, when Palestinians are killed, you very, very often see a caveat that's added, right? It says hospital says, Gaza Health Ministry says, and sometimes, especially with the BBC, Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says, because they want to cast doubt on those numbers. And yet, when Israel says they were targeting militants, or Hamas was in that school, or Hamas, there was a tunnel under that university, that is treated as fact. And so that is the problem with the way that the narrative is being presented, where one side that has a record of lying, right? There are reports, even from the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN, that come out and say, you know what? Evidence shows that the Israeli narrative was not accurate. Even when that happens, in the headlines, they are often still treated as fact. And that is, I think, the why you see the complicity of the media. Their job is to challenge the state, not copy it, not parrot it.
And, of course, other outlets are banned and on social media as well, let alone television networks in the United, as regards the United States and Europe. But then again, to the blame, if it's not the individual journalist, you're saying there are honourable exceptions, which I suppose may be the case, although it's very difficult to say when comparing the footage on your phone scrolling up with what the press is saying. Is it the media advertisers, the top advertisers over there in the US, Procter & Gamble, AbbVie, GSK, Big Pharma, basically, Disney, another pharma company, Novo Nordisk, Google, Pepsi, Amazon. They're paying the money for all these broadcasts that are clearly trying to minimize in the American public imagination the scale of the atrocity we're witnessing that most people in the global south consider to be, you know, a Holocaust. I mean, that's why Kamala Harris is known as Holocaust Harris and Biden Genocide Joe.
I mean, when you look at the way that the entire world sees this, the vast, vast majority of the world sees this issue, you can see it within, UN votes by the United Nations, right? If you look at the way that the United Nations has voted on countless resolutions having to do with condemning Israel or enforcing international law for the sake of Palestinians, you see that where the minority lies and you see where the vast majority of the world lies. And so there's a reason why that kind of the media division would happen that way as well. In terms of the corporate media that you're talking about, I mean, that questions the entire notion of the free press as well. Is it a free press if it's actually, if its concern is profitability? If the idea is to profit, then now those corporations wield some kind of power over the types of narratives that are coming out of these media platforms. And at the same time, that corporate power is exerted directly within our political system as well. I mean, you can get into the power of the very lobbies that you just referred to, several of the companies that you were talking about, whether you're talking about pharmaceutical companies, whether you're talking about foreign lobbies like AIPAC and Israel's lobby within the US. The way that money operates within the political system also lends itself to corruption within that system.
Dr. Salrad, I'll stop you there. More from the historian of the Middle East after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with historian of the Middle East and author of The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture and Identity in Modern Iran, Dr. Salrad. Dr. Rad, you were talking about the freedom of the press. I think Seymour Hersh was on this show and I think he intimated that, you know, there basically isn't one. Do you think any of these journalists in these newsrooms in NATO countries understand that peace is breaking out in this region aside from Palestine? The Saudi Arabia has made friends again with Iran, with Syria, that as has the UAE, where I'm speaking to you, that in the rest of this region, there are huge ties being forged outside of NATO frameworks and Washington proxy frameworks.
Well, anytime U.S. adversaries are, or Western adversaries, I should say more broadly, are involved in a normalization process, it's not treated the same way, right? And if you juxtapose the way, say, Chinese brokered, but then also there was a lot of regional actors like Oman, for instance, and Qatar, who very often are in the background doing a lot of that diplomatic work. When it's brokered between two states like Saudi Arabia and Iran, that is not treated in the same way as, say, the Abraham Accords and the idea that there's normalization between Arab states and Israel. And that's because it doesn't fit the political narrative. It doesn't fit the political discourse. And so that's where you really see this overlap between the media, or the mainstream media, I should say, and what is the political discourse of the state. Now, why is this important? Because according to Western officials themselves, this is what differentiates, an authoritarian state that has state-run media versus a free Western democracy that has a free press. The idea is that it's not supposed to simply mimic whatever the state is saying, but in most cases you see that. So you see normalization, attempts at normalization between Saudi Arabia and Iran, two significant sort of arch foes as they're depicted within the West. And you see normalization with other countries, with Iran. That's one of the things that the Islamic Republic has focused on in recent years, is diplomacy within its own neighborhood, right? Diplomacy within the region, a look east versus a look west. And that is never going to be painted as a positive development, because as long as it's Western adversaries who are having peaceful relations or trying to normalize relations, that's not on the political agenda within those Western countries. So it's not treated the same way. They're not even treated as alliances when there are alliances, right? They're called proxies. You never hear the word alliance being used. There are no allies, apparently, in the region. There's just proxies within the region. Whereas when you talk about the Western world, you have alliances and allies. So all of that difference in language is really just, it's not the actions of these states that matter. It's who is taking those actions.
So how will Washington punish Saudi Arabia then for not playing ball? It's clear from Blinken and Sullivan that they have high hopes, even though time and time again, Saudi Arabia said, no, we won't increase oil supply when they wanted them to. We won't normalize with Israel. And yet, if you were tuning in NATO media, you'd think, yeah, it's really on the cards, this great Biden-Harris administration idea of uniting Saudi Arabia with Israel. People are horrified in GCC countries that they can even think that would happen.
Well, you know, it's funny that you bring up Saudi Arabia and the Biden administration, because if you remember during the 2020 elections, Joe Biden sort of famously called Saudi Arabia a pariah state, right? And he said he would treat it as a pariah state. And of course, once he became president, there was the fist bump with MBS that was criticized largely in the West, because that was one of the platforms that Joe Biden ran on. He was going to be tough on Saudi Arabia. So when you ask about punishment, I don't see how this administration has in any way exacted, you know, quote, punishment on Saudi Arabia whatsoever. When it came to the case of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the same thing. The Biden administration said that.
Well, now we have details that perhaps that was a CIA op in the first place. And Khashoggi's position was highly suspicious altogether, and how the West talked about that. But, you know, I want to get onto this Harris, since the November elections is very big, isn't it? Wolf Blitzer, to remind everyone, used to work at AIPAC. He's the CNN journalist. And Dana Bash was the person who was married to a CIA-linked chief of staff. Harris chose her, Dana Bash, to get the first interview from. Clear that the election interference is not the Russians. It is clearly Israel that has a stranglehold over the elections there in the United States.
Well, that's something that's rarely talked about, the influence of not only within the lobbies, right? So you have the sort of open source information of, AIPAC boasts about this idea, right? They're like, look, AIPAC endorsed, you know, candidates, won their elections here. The amount of money that AIPAC is spending on defeating any candidate who's basically just criticizing the state of Israel in any way, all of that is in the open. What's talked about less are the sort of covert influence campaigns. And you'll see a few headlines and a few stories within Western media, but it's not covered in the same wall-to-wall coverage you get when, for instance, the target is Russia. When the discussion is about Israeli influence campaigns, you really don't get very much coverage on it. And yet there's very clear indications that those influence campaigns are happening not only out in the open, but also covertly. You can look back at the stories of Israel spying on the US back in 2015. Again, these things go, if covered, barely covered, and they're not presented with the same alarm. And I think that's one of the key distinctions. There's no alarmist attitude towards the fact that this is happening. It's almost commonplace. It's okay if Israel spies on U.S. officials. It's okay if Israel is covertly trying to influence U.S. politics. In some ways, the lines are blurred between Israeli influences being foreign influence. If you think about the fact that you have U.S. officials, right, representatives of the U.S. government going to the Capitol in IDF uniforms, right? In Israeli military uniforms. I mean, there is a very, the relationship between the US and Israel and the influence that Israel has on US politics is quite strong, but it's not something that is readily available within the Western media narrative.
Yeah, I mean, you can see why when people make these points that are clearly all true, the immediate reaction is anti-Semitism slurs on people who make these accusations. They destroyed one of the most popular Labour leaders in England, Jeremy Corbyn, for making accusations like this and talking like this, because it still seems, even from you, slightly mysterious, because you're saying these reporters on the ground are trying to do their best, they're trying to do their best. There is AIPAC, which is clearly, that's just the Israeli state doing it. Who are the individuals in the Biden-Harris administration and on the Trump campaign? RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard recently joined it. They're both opposed to any ceasefire in Gaza. Who is responsible for? I mean, it's the Israeli state that is running American democracy in general? Or are there these individuals? I mean, they're clearly donors to the Trump campaign. One donor in particular has been named the widow of a casino owner.
So, I mean, when you look at U.S. policy within Israeli, U.S. policy vis-a-vis Israel, in terms of responsibility, it starts at the top. I mean, the president of the United States is the one who is setting these policies. The vice president now, Kamala Harris, is supporting those policies. And even
and
though
they're both paid by AIPAC, right? They're both bankrolled by AIPAC, Biden and Harris.
They certainly receive funding from AIPAC, yes, as well as other lobbying groups. I think that's important to point out, too, because there are a lot of within the American political system, there are significant lobbying groups, which is the other reasons why we get policies not only outside of foreign policy, within domestic U.S. policy. There are policies that go against what the bipartisan majority of Americans want. Why does that happen? Why is there a disconnect between what our politicians actually enforce as policy versus when it's not what the bipartisan majority will of the people is? It's because you have powerful lobbies. And it's not just the Israeli lobby. You also have, for instance, pharmaceutical lobbies, right? You have arms manufacturers. You have reasons why we have endless forever wars and an inflating military budget that goes higher and higher, despite the fact that the Biden administration withdrew from Afghanistan and boasted about this idea that, oh, we're ending America's longest war. Following the end of America's longest war, they increased the military budget again. So what explains this kind of phenomenon is multiple lobbies that are working within the country.
Not that the Arab League could just give a few briefcases to the Biden administration and suddenly they'd care about the dying, murdered, slaughtered children of Gaza, though.
No, because I think it's more complex, right? I think if you just break it down as that is the only factor, then you're simplifying something where there's also, I mean, there are strong cultural and ideological roots within this as well, right? Because of the way this is not new, this narrative is not new within this country. So you see it not only within the media, but also within the popular culture discourse and also within the political discourse. And this has been the case for many decades. So there's also an ideological component that I think is often left out of it. I mean, you have Joe Biden talking about very proudly the idea that he is a Zionist. And he says this repeatedly, and he says it over and over again. He says things like repeatedly that no Jewish person would be safe without the state of Israel. Now, this is the president of a country that has a significant Jewish population. And yet he is basically saying that he cannot protect his own citizens if they are Jewish. So that kind of language also has a strong ideological component. And I think that's something that's important to take into consideration when you want to understand the complexity of a system that brings us these policies. But in terms of responsibility, the responsibility is on the officials that are imposing these policies. The responsibility is on the president, the vice president, the Secretary of State, Secretary of State Blinken, who is consistently whitewashing Israel's crimes. This is someone, if you look at someone, the figure of Secretary Blinken, outspoken when it comes to U.S. adversaries. But when Israel is the one committing war crimes, he has, not only does he have nothing to say about it, he's continuously placing blame exclusively on Hamas without placing any blame on Israel, despite the fact that we have mass civilian casualties. They reject the idea that genocide is being committed. They reject every international institution, whether it's the ICC or the ICJ or the UN itself, when it is trying to impose consequences for Israel. So responsibility starts at the top, and responsibility is of that of these officials and the media institutions that are complicit because they mimic whatever those officials say, rather than challenging them.
Yeah, and Blinken supports Zelensky, and there's statues of Bandera going up in Ukraine. So it's not even anything to do with Jewishness, because they're erasing the memory of Jews killed in the Holocaust in Ukraine. So what exactly is it? And are they successful? Have they broadly been successful at, because this time round things have been different, not only because of the scale of the slaughter, but in your country there have been mass opposition to the pro-Israel policy of the US government. Polls show people support Palestine in the United States, but they've successfully stopped all the massive student protests with the violence and intimidation. And they've even not covered people who burn themselves to death outside Israeli consulates, which I know you've commented on. What do you think about the fact they've hide Aaron Bushnell, of course, self-immolated for Palestine at the DC consulate, and now we've had Matt Nelson in Boston killing himself? They've done well.
But in terms of the self-immolations, I mean, the reason why Aaron Bushnell's story reached the audience that it did and got the coverage that it did was because he made a video that explicitly stated why he was doing the act he was about to take, right? And it was unavoidable, essentially, to end the fact that this is he was an active service of the military, of the U.S. military. So that combination is the only reason where Aaron Bushnell got some attention. But you had a self-immolation case before that, and now a new self-immolation case in the U.S. And they've gotten I have not been able to find a story about the recent self-immolation of Matt Nelson in Boston, outside of a local Boston paper. And even that headline and the story itself mentions nothing about the Israeli consulate. So it's sort of those stories, it's mind-blowing to see how little coverage there is and how little concern there is for the fact that there have been three Americans who have self-immolated in protest to U.S. policy in Gaza, to the fact that the U.S. is complicit in a genocide.
Dr. Sarad, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US EO-armed genocide here in the Middle East. On Monday, we turn to the self-sanctioning European Union when we speak to Irish politician Mick Wallace ahead of the second anniversary of perhaps the world's biggest ever man-made methane climate-changing event, the alleged Biden-Harris bombing of the $11 billion Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.